Welcome to the Andy Stanley Leadership Podcast, a conversation designed to help leaders go further, faster. Today, we are talking about creating high-performance teams in your organization. First, we will listen to a portion of one of Andy's talks entitled High-Performance Teams. Afterwards, Andy will spend some time with us unpacking this idea a little further.
What I want to do real quick is I want to give you four essentials. Again, there are more than these, but here are four essentials. And each one of these has a little bit of a homework assignment. And let me just tell you up front, okay, this is hard stuff, okay? This is hard. What I'm going to ask you to do, especially as it relates to this first one, this is going to take a lot of time. Now, there are some of you that just hate staff retreats. You hate staff meetings. Just let's get in, get it out, get in, get out. Let's don't waste a lot of time talking about a bunch of stuff. If you're kind of wired that way, you are probably not a good team leader. That doesn't mean you're not effective. Doesn't mean you haven't accomplished a lot. You're probably not a good team leader because what I'm going to talk about requires some time. It requires some conversation. It requires, in some cases, as a senior leader, it requires what seems at times to be almost like a waste of time. But if you are able to harness and bring into synergy and bring into, you know, to streamline the gifts and talents and passion of your staff, you're just going to go further, faster, with a lot less effort. So here's the four essentials. Letter A clearly defined problem. A clearly defined problem. A clearly defined problem. I'm not talking about a goal. This is better than a goal. A clearly defined problem, basically, you're answering the question. Here's the question. What won't happen if we don't do what God has called us to do? What is the problem that won't be solved in our community if we don't do what God has called us to do? What's the problem that won't be solved in student culture if we don't do what God's called us to do? What's going to happen to families if we don't do what God has called us to do? You can ask this question. In fact, you must ask it in terms of your entire organization, and then every leader within the organization needs to look at their department or division and define what is the problem we're here to solve. Now, this kind of puts a twist on goal setting and mission statements and all that stuff. I'm all for all that stuff. But if you will take the time to have the discussion, to drill down, and come up with, what problem is this team here to solve? I'm telling you, defining your goal and your mission in terms of problem solving will give you some passion and some energy. And then all of a sudden, people begin to think in terms of, gee, if we don't do this, something important won't get done. The problem with simply a goal is an add to. Problem solving is often defined, or phrasing things as a problem sets things up as, hey, if we don't do something, something good won't happen. Something will fail. Somebody's not going to, you know, enter the kingdom. A family isn't going to be reached. There's a real genuine problem here, and God has called us to solve it. And your organization needs to understand what's the problem. What's the problem that God has called your organization to solve? And not just in a macro level, but all the way down. Number one, this gives a team a reason to be. Number two, this creates the context for passion. I pull this out of Pat McMillan's book. It's a great book on team building. He says this, a clear, common, compelling task, and that would be where I'm putting problem, a clear, common, compelling task that is important to the individual team members is the single best factor in team success. Now, that's a huge statement he's making. That the single most important factor in terms of a team really being successful is a clearly defined task, or what I would say, a problem that's got to be solved. Number three, teams dissolve when the problems are all solved. Teams dissolve when the problems are all solved. The reason your staff meetings are boring is because you don't show up with this sense of urgency, there's something we got to do, and if we don't do it, it won't get done. And the reason is you've either never defined the problem you're there to solve, or it got solved and you've never found another problem to solve. So consequently, you're just kind of getting together and, you know, eating bagels and drinking coffee and waiting for the staff meeting to get over with. There's no passion. If nobody wants to show up, if people are saying, our meetings are a waste of time. You know what? Problem solving meetings built around genuine problems are never boring. They're never a waste of time. So if your meetings are a waste of time, it's because you don't know the problem that God's called you to solve in your community, or you've lost sight of it, or you've decided you're just too busy doing church to get down and dirty and do what God's called you to do in your community. And you know what? I've never been to your community, but I can tell you part of the problem that God's called you to solve. Irrelevant church environments. If 40 or 50 or 60 or 70% of the people in your community drive by churches every Sunday and it doesn't even dawn on them they ought to try to go by, you have a huge problem in your community. And if you're a church leader, that's the problem that God has called you to solve. And I'm just telling you, okay, from experience. If you spend the time drilling down on that question and figuring out what is the problem God has called to solve, here's what happened, I promise you. As you drill down and get closer and closer and closer to identifying it, the passion in your staff goes up and up and up and up and up and up. And suddenly people whose hearts have not been engaged, suddenly their hearts are engaged because they realize we are important. If we don't do what God has called us to do, something important won't happen in this community. And suddenly there's emotion attached, not simply to a goal, but to what God has called you to do. Now, I'm assuming most of you have read this book. Have most of you read Seven Practices? Don't raise your hand. That's embarrassing. I'm not trying to sell books, okay? Seven Practices. Here's why you need to get this book. The first part of this book, we talk about clarify the when. That's what I'm talking about. The whole first section of this book is clarify the when. That is, it's looking through the lens, each lens of your departments and your division and your whole church saying, what is the when for us? Because a team can't function as a team unless there's a when. This is why sports analogies are so perfect when it comes to teams, because every sports team knows exactly what the win is. Every sports team knows exactly what the problem is that has to be solved. Every sports team knows exactly what the goal is. But when it comes to staff teams, hey, you can be a staff member of an organization and go for years and years and years and years and never have clarified the win. And as long as the money's coming in and people are getting paid, you know, life just goes on. But if you want a team, then you're going to have to spend some time asking the question, what is the problem God has called us to solve? What is the problem God has called us to solve as an organization and within the organization? What is the problem that's in your notes? What is the problem your team must solve? Letter B. Then you need an agreed upon solution. An agreed upon solution. Now listen carefully. Not just the right solution. An agreed upon solution. Now here's where I understand, because I'm as impatient as any leader in this room. There are times when I feel like, okay, here's what God wants us to do. Everybody knows what God wants us to do. We got the question. Da, 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 da. And I'm thinking, okay, I don't want to have a bunch of discussion. Let me just tell you what we need to do. Because I'm sure I'm right. Number one, I've been thinking about it longer than everybody else, right? Because I'm the leaders. I think about this stuff all the time. I just started a meeting. They've had 20 minutes to think about it. I've been thinking about it for 3 days, getting ready for the meeting. So not only do I have, the question, I think I have the solution. And I don't want to spend 3 hours discussing something that I know I already have the answer to. You ever had that feeling? If you just want to be a boss with employees, then you just tell them what they need to do. And you may be exactly right. If you want a team, then you need an agreed upon solution. And that takes time. And sometimes it takes a lot of time. And every once in a while, you may discover that you were... wrong. Number one, agreement necessitates unfiltered debate. I love that phrase. That came out of Al Lencioni, one of his books, The Five Dysfunctions of a Team. Agreement necessitates unfiltered debate. Number two, I can't concede my point until I know you have heard me out. See, in a team, it's not simply about making the right decisions. It's about everybody at an emotional level owning the decision. It's not about coming up with the right strategy. It's about all the key players emotionally embracing the strategy and simply laying it out there and doing a PowerPoint presentation and giving everybody assignment. Hey, that's great. You're the boss. You got a bunch of Indians running out doing what you want them to do. That's not a team. You will not go further faster. You will not do it with less energy. You'll have to spend more. And you'll wonder why you just don't have the hearts of your people, why you just have them running around doing stuff. I love this phrase, this quote from Five Dysfunctions. Only when everyone has put their opinions and perspectives on the table can the team confidently commit to a decision. Let me read that again. This is huge. Only when everyone has put their opinions and perspectives on the table can the team confidently commit to a decision. And look up here just for 1 second. Here's the deal. You need your team, you need your staff to commit to the decision, not simply agree to the decision. We want our staff to commit to the decision, wholeheartedly embrace the decision, not just agree to fulfill a responsibility. Because we want synergy. And for that to happen, there has got to be an environment in which you and your key leadership, and for the whole church or your student ministry or your children's ministry or whatever team you're leading, there's got to be an environment where there is enough discussion, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes, to where there is time for people to wholeheartedly come to the conclusion that you feel God has led the team to, and you may not even know what that is going to the meeting, and that people can wholeheartedly embrace it, knowing, let me finish that sentence, knowing that it has tapped into the collective wisdom of the entire group. Number three, every team member must buy in before they will wholeheartedly pitch in. Every team member must buy in before they wholeheartedly pitch in. People will commit their hearts to a task, to a cause, but not a task. This is huge. People will commit their hearts to a cause, but not a task. I think, unfortunately, because we get in a hurry at times, we hand out assignments. And because people work for us and we give them paychecks, they say, yes, sir, yes, ma'am, and off they go. But if you want their hearts involved, there has got to be an environment where they can not only help you define what is the problem we're trying to solve, but they have input into the solution. It's not enough to hand out assignments. I wrote in my notes, you can assign tasks and get their hands, but you won't capture their hearts until they buy into your solution. So here's the question, second question. What is the solution? What is the problem God has called you to solve? What is the solution? What is the problem God has called your student ministry to solve? What is the solution? What is the problem that God has called your church and your community to solve? What is the solution? What is the problem that God has called your missions department, division, and committee to solve? What is the solution? Asking that question, answering that question, and spending the time answering it. I'm telling you, it is absolutely critical if you want more than employees, more than a staff, if you want to function as a team. The number three, clearly assigned roles. Clearly assigned roles. That is, everybody's got to know what their part is in terms of carrying this out. Number one, every team member needs to know exactly what is expected of them. One of the best things I did, and this was as helpful to me as I think it was for our staff, but years and years ago, I sat down and I made a list of our key staff, and I used to have five direct reports, and it was six, then it was seven, then it was eight, then it was seven, then it was nine, then it was back to seven. It's changed through the years. But I sat down with my key staff people, and I came up with a one-sentence job description for them. This took me a long time, and every time I read, some of these people say, can I get a copy of that? And the answer is no, I'm not going to give you a copy of this, so don't ask. This is your exercise. This took me a long time, but I thought, you know what? I want to be able to look at Julie Arnold and say, okay, Julie, I realize you're in charge of host teams, parking lot, if I'm dressed right, if my mic's on, the sound, the lights, the audio, the sketches, the video, the camera, the guitar players, if the singers have too short a skirt on, you know, if the guy has too ripped up jeans. I mean, what, you know, she is responsible, not just for this campus, for three campuses. I mean, the breadth of her responsibility is breathtaking. It makes me tired to think about what Julie does. I decided, you know what, I want to give her just one sentence. Julie, if all else fails, in my mind, I want you to understand what I see as your role in this organization. So let me read you her one-sentence job description. To create an unforgettable experience for those who attend our worship services. That's it. Julie, I don't know about all the details, and I know the world's falling apart, but here's all I want you to know. Here's all I want you to know. Your job, should you decide to accept it, is to create an unforgettable worship experience for those who attend our services. That's it. That's your role. I went through with each one of our key people, and I'm telling you, this is hard. See, it sounds so simple when I say it. I had like a paragraph of stuff for her. I'll read you another one for Bill Willits, who you met yesterday, to create and give leadership to an expanding network of small groups. That's it. That's your job description. To create and give leadership to an expanding network of small groups. If at the end of the day, you don't know what you're doing, Bill, and I've told you 25 things to do and everything's just going crazy, you just open that bottom drawer and read, Andy wants me to create an expanding network, lead and create an expanding network of small groups. That's your one sentence job description. One of the greatest things you can do as a leader, and we don't do this, well, we think we've done it, but I learned the hard way. I don't do it as well as I think I have. And I think I've done it better than I've actually done it. One of the greatest gifts you can give to your staff is clarity in terms of what you expect of them. A three-page job description is not clarity. They read the first page carefully, they sort of read the second one, they scanned the third one, and then they lost the entire document and went to work.
Okay, Andy, high-performance teams. We talk a lot about teams and teamwork. How do you distinguish as an organizational leader between employees, just having employees, and creating a team?
Well, actually, the way you ask the question is the answer. You hire employees, but you have to create a team. And the assumption is, you know, a leader, again, a department, a division, a whole organization, looks at the people who are working there and assume, well, this is my team. But you really don't hire a team. You hire employees. And the difference is when you have a team, you've got a group of people that have come around an agreed upon problem to solve, which is part of the talk. With employees, they have problems they want to solve, but generally their greatest concerns are not their problems at work. It's their problems somewhere else. Everybody has problems they want to solve. Everybody has something they want to achieve. But when you have a team, you've got a group of people who at least, you know, 20 or 30% of their thought and energy is going to go into this agreed upon goal you want to accomplish as an organization. So, you know, employees show up for a paycheck. A team shows up to accomplish something together.
That's great. I guess at a macro level, how do you create and foster a high-performance team?
I talked about this a little bit in the clip that we just heard. You have to create a team around a very, very defined problem to solve. And I like the idea of solving a problem rather than accomplishing a goal, because when you pitch it in terms of a problem, oftentimes there's as much energy as a goal. But the best analogy is the one that's probably overused. It's a sports team. And any sports team has all the components of a great organizational team. The win is very, very clear. I mean, when a team shows up, whether it's soccer, baseball, or whatever, there's no doubt in anyone's mind what the win is. And in the same way, when you create a sports team, you don't hire or you don't recruit your best friends. You don't recruit people that you just happen to know. Once you've defined the goal, then you ask the question, you know, what kind of people and what kind of gifts and what kind of skills do I need to accomplish that goal? And then once the goal is clear, you're able to hire to the skill set that you need to accomplish the goal. Sometimes in church world, pastors will ask me, they'll say, in fact, I get this a lot, you know, who should I hire first? Who should I hire first? And I always say, what are you trying to do? And what they're asking me is, what position? Do I need to hire a children's person? Do I need to hire a worship leader? Do I need to hire an educational director? You know, they're thinking in terms of position. But you never start with position. You start with the goal. Because once the goal is clear, who you need to hire becomes pretty evident. But unfortunately, in so many organizations, it's a matter of, I need somebody, I need somebody, I need somebody. Let's look at a lot of applications, hire a bunch of people. And you may get a bunch of employees, but you don't necessarily have a team. When I assembled our original team for North Point, one of the most uncomfortable conversations I had was with a guy who had worked with me before in my previous church, who knew I was assembling this team, who kind of hung out with our group, assuming that as I put together this team, he would be one of the insiders. And eventually, I think it became apparent to him that he wasn't going to be. And I had this dilemma of, do I address this or do I just ignore it and move on? And I ended up hiring somebody that was not as close to me as this particular person. But I knew as I looked at the skill set we needed, as I looked at the empty seats on the bus and trying to get the right people on the bus, as much as I love this guy, as competent as he was in what, you know, he had been doing, and as much as we'd worked together, it just wasn't the right hire. And it was very, very awkward. But I think that's the difference. When an organizational leader is very, very clear on what they're trying to do, I think it becomes pretty apparent with just a little bit of thought, what kind of people do I need? And I think it allows us to overcome the inertia of just hiring people we're comfortable with, hiring people that are like, you know, just like us, hiring people that we've worked for in the past. But the goal, or the key rather, is to have a very, very defined win. And again, like with a sports franchise, once the win is declared, it's a lot easier to put together a team.
And that's a great way to look at it. Look at it as a problem to solve. And when we talk about it in the context of teams, and you know, everybody's come to the team with a different perspective. Yep. Everyone's got a different way they look at life. And so I guess the question is how do you as a leader achieve an agreed-upon solution with so many different perspectives?
This is a huge question, and we probably don't have time to look at all the angles on this. But, you know, I guess there's two extreme approaches. One is I walk in as the leader and say, okay, I've thought about this. I've prayed about this. That's what we do in church world. I've prayed about this. You know, I've fasted, and we all know what the problem is, and here's what the solution is, okay? So, Frank, you do this, and Betty, you do this, and you start handing out assignments, and, you know, go team, and, you know, a bunch of employees run out of the room with a bunch of assignments and to-do lists. There's that approach. And the problem is there are leaders who are so intuitive in their leadership and have developed so much expertise around in their field, they have the ability to do that. They can look at a problem, immediately know what the solution is, walk into a boardroom, hand out assignments, and they will be exactly right. but they won't have a team. Because what I've learned a long time ago, and in some cases the hard way, when you have a competent leadership team, these are individuals that don't mind being told what they need to accomplish, but they don't want to be told how to do it. And the problem with the leader who has all the answers, even if that leader he or she is right, is the tendency is to say, here's what I want you to do, here's how I want you to do it, and here's when it needs to be done by. Not good grammar, but you get my point. The problem is, the more competent a person is, the less likely they are to want to be in a group that's considered a team where they're told how to do everything they've been asked to do. So, again, that has a lot to do with kind of gearing back. So the answer to the question is, I've learned in times when I'm not clear on what needs to be done and at times when I feel like I've been very clear, the best approach is to get the team in the room, present the problem, and talk as long as we need to talk until we come up, until we come upon an agreed-upon solution, but an agreed-upon solution that I have 100% buy-in. Because as the leader of the organization, I can't be 80% for it. And there have been times I've walked in where I felt like I knew the answer, but I just decided, you know what, it may take us 3 hours, and this sounds terrible, it may take us 3 hours for everybody to get to my conclusion. But I've learned, this is important, the process is more important than the product. I've seen so many occasions where leaders had the right answer, never gave their team an opportunity to have buy-in, and consequently, they weren't able to get the ball down the field, not because the solution was wrong or the question was wrong, but there just wasn't the consensus. And in a team, there has to be consensus. And unfortunately, that takes lots of conversations, lots of discussion, and the stronger the leaders that you have, you know, the stronger your leaders are, again, as you just said, Evan, they come in with an opinion and an agenda, and that's not an easy conversation. So a lot of leaders just want to skip it, just walk in and say, I've prayed about it, you know, God has spoken, or, you know, the last job I had or the last time, you know, this happened, and they just want to give out instructions. But when you do that, you don't have a team. You just have a bunch of people running out and doing lots of stuff.
Right, the whole lone genius. And yeah, everyone's totally, by themselves.
Totally. There have been two occasions when I came to a meeting absolutely convinced that I knew the answer. One had to do with a construction decision when we were building our first building, and one had to do with a capital campaign. And I came to the meeting prepared to sell my answer. Everybody came to these meetings knowing what we were going to talk about, and I was going to try to let there be open conversation. But at the end of the night, and these were about 4 years apart, I just knew what we were supposed to do. And I went into those meetings, allowed the discussion to take place, and the longer the discussion went, the less convinced I became that I had the solution to these two particular problems. And at the end of those meetings, I totally changed my position. And these are two decisions that impacted the entire organization, and if I had had my way, we would have made two huge blunders, and one would have cost us a lot of money. So, you know, those are two very humbling experiences that reminded me that I'm not just to be a consensus builder around my good ideas and my solutions. As a leader, I have to be a consensus builder around the right solutions and the right ideas. And that means oftentimes, you know, leaving my agenda and leaving my solutions at the door. And in both of those meetings, those two groups knew where I was headed and where I wanted them to go. But fortunately, I had great people around me who said, Andy, you know, you may be the pastor and you may be the boss, but you're just wrong on this. And if you choose to go in that direction, we will support you, but you need to know it's not the right answer. And again, I look back and just breathe a sigh of relief. But again, there's no leader goes in without an opinion to a discussion. That's not going to happen. But are we able to be neutral enough to allow God to move, as we talk about in our world? And I think that's true in business or ministry. And are we neutral enough to allow the smart people to really interact and not feel like they're just a rubber stamp for the leader in the organization? But when you have that kind of consensus, when you have an agreed-upon solution to an agreed-upon problem, then you have a team.
Well, it kind of brings me to another point here. There was a fourth essential. We didn't get a chance to hear it in the clip. It's in the full message. But it talks a little bit about these relationships. And the essential is ensuring that the team has a clear understanding of the interdependency among other team members. What are some practical ways you as a leader can help achieve this?
Well, interdependency, you know, it's for a while it was a real buzzword in the 80s because of Stephen Covey's book. but I don't hear it talked about very much anymore, but interdependency is a reality of every organization in the sense that you either have it or you don't. Interdependency is when I am convinced, not that I've been told, but when I'm convinced that I can't do what I'm supposed to do unless you do what you're supposed to do. That in a sense, all the dots are connected. I realize my responsibility, but I realize my responsibility and success is contingent upon other people fulfilling their responsibility and doing what they've been asked to do. So in organizational life, it's very important, and this is the responsibility of the leader. It's so important to help people connect the dots. For some people, that's easy. They understand their interdependency. For other people, whether it's personality or isolation or the nature of their job, they work in a vacuum or they work in a silo and, you know, they just do what they do and they're not aware of their interdependency with everybody else. So my responsibility as a leader is to make sure people are aware of, and the word I like to use is they got to feel their interdependency. They need to come to work every single day knowing I've got to do my part because my part connects with somebody else's part. Now, in organizational life, that is a daily reality. But the question is, do the people in our organization feel that? Now, again, sports team analogy, you know, the guy playing first base, he knows the dots are all connected. You know, there's no one-man team in baseball or football or basketball. Everybody is aware, you know, moment by moment in a sports environment, the interdependency. But that's the same reality in organizational life. The question for me as a leader and for our listeners is, have we helped people understand their interdependency, and do they feel it every day when they come to work? One of the practical things we do to foster interdependency on our staff is on a quarterly basis. When our staff comes into our all-staff meeting, we do that once a month for all three campuses, we will have note cards and envelopes on tables, and we say for the first few minutes in our time together today, we're all going to write thank you notes. I want you to think of someone, either staff or volunteer, who because of what they did yesterday would be a Sunday, these meetings are on Monday, because of what they did yesterday, you were able to do what you feel like God has called you to do here. And that thank you note is just a moment to go, oh yeah, I couldn't do what I do if it weren't for these other people doing what they've been called to do. So it's just a reminder, because organizational life is fast-paced, and it's easy to think that I am my own person, I do my own thing, and the sun rises and sets around, you know, the fulfillment of my responsibility. So I think anything, again, that reminds people of the reality of their interdependency creates and fosters a healthy staff culture. I think another thing that I've tried to do on a consistent basis is with our leadership team, our management team, there are 10 people in that meeting. At the beginning of the year, I say to them, what can I do or how can I serve in your world to help you go further and faster with what you've been called to do? So I'll say to our Global X guy, Derwin Steed, who does all of our cross-cultural mission stuff, I say, Derwin, what can I do this year? I can't do five things, but what one thing could I do in your world that would help you? And he'll say, hey, it'd be great if you came in and did this. And I'll say to our student pastor, okay, Kevin, what can I do for you this year? And by saying that, I am reminding them that I realize that their success depends on me and my success depends on them. And as a leader, if I can enter their world, not as their boss, but if I can enter their world as someone who is going to serve them, not work for them, but serve them for a particular project or for a particular event, then I want to do that. And again, it's just a reminder and a visual in that staff meeting. I'm aware that you need me in your world, and I want you to remain aware that you need me in your world as well, and we need each other. So again, you know, there's no magic to any of that, but I think as leaders sit down and think about the rhythm of their organization, and if they can ask the question, what can I do on a consistent basis to remind people that we are interdependent? As I said to a guy the other day, it was one of our production staff. He works behind the scenes. No one would know his name. He is in the dark every Sunday, you know, in the nooks and crannies of the building, you know, doing faders and stuff. And he was just thanking me for my ministry. And I said, Bob, I said, think about this. If it weren't for you, I would be standing on my front porch preaching to whoever I could gather in my yard. I mean, I appreciate you being grateful, but if it weren't for you, you know, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. I get lots of credit, but it takes both of us to make Sunday morning happen, along with a lot of other people. So again, it's just looking for opportunities to remind people that we're interdependent and trying to help them feel that sense of interdependency.
So Andy, in summary, What is the one takeaway you want leaders to remember on the topic of high-performance teams?
I guess my final comment would be this, that developing a real team is very time-consuming. It takes longer than it takes to just hire a bunch of people. It's not simply about filling a lot of slots and making sure all the cubes are filled and all the responsibilities are covered. Developing a real team is about a lot of hard, long meetings, a lot of consensus building, taking strong personalities, allowing them to have an unfiltered debate, but at the end of the day, coming around the solution to a problem that you feel like, and in our case, we feel like God wants us to accomplish. So it takes a lot of patience, it takes a lot of hard work, but when a leader has a real team, they will always go further, faster.
Andy, that's great. Thanks so much for sharing with us.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much for joining us. To purchase the Drive 06 Session 5 MP3 that covers this topic as well as other leadership resources from Andy, please visit northpointresources.org.